Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to a hybrid episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I am Hafa Sellers Ross.
If you can hear the sound of crashing waves and disappointing gelato in the background, it's because once again we are recording direct from the Venice Film Festival. So please forgive our unbearable smugness as we record from the beach bed that I have been calling my office for the past week. We'll also be reviewing new releases El Conde and Past Lives, and we have an interview with you from the incredible director Celine Song. All coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, I mean, time is at the essence when it comes to these film festivals. So, shall we just get straight into it? Our first film, El Conde, is out this week. First up, we have El Conde. Augusto Pinochet never died. Rather, he is a vampire who, after 250 years, decides to die due to his complicated family situation and the dishonor of his figure. So, Hafa, this is coming out for people, but this was also like one of the earliest films of the festival. Was this one of your more anticipated things, the new Lorraine?
Yeah, I have been a massive Lorraine fan for quite a few years. I am South American, so I am slightly biased, but I remember seeing his early work pop up in festivals and have been quite enamored with his work since then. And he's returning to a theme that has been very familiar in his career. So he was last in Venice 2 years ago with Spencer, and now he's back to Pinochet and exploring the ripples of the Chilean dictatorship in his work. He has famously done a trilogy of Tony Manero, Postmortem and No, which were all explorations of that period in time. So I was very curious to see what he was going to do with this one.
I mean, you and I were Spencer defenders, which is not something that's popular over with Little White Lies, but did this kind of live up to those expectations?
Oh, 1,000%. I feel like the idea of using this framework of a black and white satire, a vampiristic satire, to talk about the impact of the legacy of Pinochet and how it is still alive despite the body of the dictator being buried under 7 layers of earth, is really interesting. And I think it's a film that is not only beautiful to look at, but is very much on the nose in a way that I think works really well. And I think people will be like, oh, the entire thing about the film is that fascism is bad. And it is bad, you guys. And fascism has been rising in South America quite terrifyingly over the past few years. It's just been a few weeks since there was an assassination of a presidential candidate who has vouched to stop corruption and the right-wing parties, and we elected Lula in Brazil less than a year ago.
Thank God.
And I think that people will be like, oh, is there a need to say that fascism is bad? And I'm telling you, there is. And
there's a need in the West as well.
Like, 1,000%, yeah.
We're in Italy right now, and we know that like the rise of the far right here has been a massive concern for people as well. So it seems like people do need the mind.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yes, sadly. I mean, yeah, it's a weird cyclical thing because obviously this festival was founded by Mussolini. Now we come back to not a million miles away rule. But yeah, Hannah, for you, did this all work? I mean, it's kind of like fantastical reimagination of like a very difficult historical figure.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of alluded to Little White Lies' stance on Spencer. I really do not like Spencer as a film. I'm very into the other Lorraine films I have seen, so I really like Emma, I really like Jackie, but yeah, for whatever reason, Spencer didn't really land for me. Maybe it was Stephen Knight's fault, I don't know, who's to say. But El Conde, I was very excited about. I love a vampire movie, and I like the very on-the-noseness of this whole, like, politicians as monsters, kind of. It is a metaphor, but it's so obvious as to kind of be like, well, is it really? It's so on the nose. But I mean, I do think it really works. I think I was surprised at just how funny the film was. It has this like narrative device of this voiceover, which is kind of like this omnipresent narrator who knows everything and speaking this very British, staid voice. And you're kind of thinking like, who is this? Why does that voice sound so familiar? And then there's like a reveal quite late in the film, which I found very funny, one of the film's best bits. And also I think kind of nod to The Great Dictator in like, mm-hmm. you know, this black and white, obviously Chaplin was shooting out of black and white out of necessity, but like, yeah, this idea of framing a monster, a human monster, in a kind of comical way, I think is something that can seem dismissive. I found mm-hmm. Jojo Rabbit didn't really work for me because it kind of felt like it was...
No, on that we are agreed.
Yeah, it was kind of, I don't know, just a very weird way of framing arguably the most evil man that ever lived.
Hard competition.
It was a hard competition in Pinochet, yeah. And very other dictators are available. But I actually think that the kind of horror of it all is never, like, undersold in the story. You know, you know, we see him, like, Pinochet and his family, his other vampires, eating like these like bloody hearts, which is quite like, even in black and white, it's quite graphic. And my only kind of issue is like the gender politics of the film, I think, are a bit weird. Like, mm-hmm. it's kind of, it does feel lightly misogynistic to me because it kind of implies that, like, well, Pinochet was bad, but his wife was even worse, which apparently is like a... There is some like scholarship around this that suggests that he was kind of at the whim of his wife.
Did the patriarchy write the scholarship?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't
yeah.
you think it is wonderful to know that women can be terrible too?
I think it's actually quite helpful.
Yeah. Not since Macbeth have I been so empowered.
Yeah.
But I did have a good time with it. And I do think it's a very kind of interesting way of shedding light on a part of world history that people outside of like Latin America might not be that familiar with. Certainly I'm not, like, mm-hmm. you know, by the time I was born, Pinochet had been out of power for a little bit. So it's kind of something that, you know, forgive my ignorance, listeners, I didn't know much about. So it was kind of, refreshing in that sense as well, that, like, I'm glad Netflix are partnering with Lorraine on this, and hopefully it will get seen by a kind of wide audience. So it played really early in the competition, and we were saying a lot of people might have missed it here. So hopefully they'll take the time.
Yeah, I hope so. I missed it, so I'm just taking your word for it. But it is very interesting to see that kind of like someone coming into kind of like the story is more of a newbie and somebody that's more kind of like that's part of like, mm-hmm. you know, something that they're very familiar with, both had like a positive reaction to it.
Yeah, I would just say I am slightly biased, but I think Lorraine is one of our most interesting and most just multidisciplinary and then creative directors that we have working right now. I think he can do no wrong when he's playing with different genres, and I'm just a big fan of the work that he does when he goes to Hollywood. I'm a fan of the work that he does when he goes back home, and I am with you. I hope that people see this. I think it is slightly odd that Netflix has come here with this film on the first day of the festival and is just premiering very, very quickly after. Mm. There's not an entire trajectory of festivals that this film is going to do. Mm. So I am believing in the good taste of people to go and click on this little odd black and white film about a vampire dictator. I do hope they do see it because I think it's great.
I will be, because I arrived a little bit late, so I got to miss. So this is going to be a Netflix watch for me. I mean, as a result, I can't do scores because I haven't seen it. But Hannah, do you want to take the lead on those in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'm going to say a 3 in anticipation, obviously, because I wasn't really a big fan of Spencer. And I think sometimes, these films can kind of go either way when it's like a director passion project. But I did trust Lorraine. You know, he's very, like... He knows a lot about the man as well. He's made like 3 films about Pinochet before, in some manner about Pinochet. He did this little trilogy back in the day. So I did think, you know, he was more than capable of handling it. But definitely a 4 in enjoyment. In retrospect, I'm going to give it a 3 just because I've seen so many great films this week. And I think like maybe it's, you know, a little hazy in my memory, but I would happily rewatch it for sure. I don't think 3 is a bad score at all.
Well, yeah, it depends on how you kind of view the three-starification of film criticism via Rotten Tomatoes, but a subject for another time. Hafa, what about you, in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
To me, it was a big five in anticipation because he is, as I have said, I think five times by now, one of my favorite filmmakers. I love his films. I was very thrilled to be able to watch Spencer here 2 years ago, and I was looking forward to repeating the opportunity and the experience. So it was a big five. Enjoyment, that's a four, I think. It is a film of a cinephile. It is full of very direct references to great works of art. It is The Passion of Joan of Arc. You have a little bit of Black Narcissus in there. You have, as Hannah said, some Chaplin references and some references to his earlier work as well. So I think it's a very well-crafted film. And overall, it's a four. It's a very strong film for me. I think it is greatly realized. I think it is funny. It is writers. It is important. And I do hope that not having a massive theatrical release won't affect it, because I think it's a great film. So four.
Oh, well, quite the recommendation. That is what I will be doing once I arrive home and collapse on the sofa and sleep for 2 days as the protagonist of Priscilla does, because I'm so exhausted. But next up, it's Past Lives.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Nora and Haesun, two deeply connected childhood friends, are wrestled apart after Nora's family emigrates from South Korea. Decades later, they are reunited for one fateful week as they confront destiny, love, and the choices they made in life. Before we get on to the review, here is David Jenkins with the director Celine Song.
Well, Celine, thank you so much for giving us time to chat to you about Past Lives. I guess the first question I'd like to ask you about the film is, like, I'd love you to talk a bit about how you kind of came to make this story and this material into a film. Because I know that you come from a background of being a playwright. And was Past Lives the first time that you'd ever felt that impulse to kind of move to the sort of medium of film? Or had that inkling been with you before?
Well, I think that it really does have to come from what the story is and what's sort of the best way to tell the story. And I knew that this particular story needed to be told cinematically because of the nature of the time and space in it. So I think that, you know, what's to me the primary difference between working in theater and working in film is that while theater is dealing in time and space that is figurative, and film is dealing in space and time that is literal. So I felt like this particular story needed to be told literally when it comes to time and space, because it is a movie about cities. It's a movie about different places that we live. And actually, the way that these two main characters, Nora and Haesung, the way that they live in two different cities actually is a very big part of why they cannot be together, or why it's so difficult for them to connect. And the continent-spanning part of it can only be really felt if these two locations feel very different and they feel like they're on a, you know, different part of the world, which they are. So I think that because of that, the cities themselves are characters in the movie, and they're actually a very big part of character too. And I think that made me believe that these cities should be depicted literally, which is right for a cinematic form. And then, of course, when it comes to time, this movie is about aging. In theater, what's amazing about theater is that you can have a 40-year-old woman play a 15-year-old boy if you wanted to. And the whole audience will come along, and that's what's amazing about it, right? But I knew that what would be such a central part of this particular story is that because it spans decades, and because that actually is matters, and that's a very big part of the storytelling, that I really felt that you needed to see these characters as children, played by children, and then, of course, for it to be juxtaposed and contradict, but also coexist with these very children grown up, depicted by full grown-ups. Mm-hmm. And I think that really was what drove me to believe that this should be a movie and not a stage play.
You talked a bit about the depiction of the cities in the film and the cities being these characters in the film. And could you talk a bit about how you went about creating these visions of I guess New York, and we see a little bit of Seoul as well. They feel quite positive, benign depictions, and that there's a real sense that Nora, as much as she's in love with her partner, she's also in love with America and New York, and you can kind of see why.
Of course. Well, I think that, you know, the way that I wanted to depict New York is honestly mainly authentically. So the way that I, because as I myself live in New York, and therefore I know what it is like to live in the city, and the way that the city is, and, you know, everything is in the eyes of the beholder. And New York City in the eyes of a New Yorker is a different thing altogether. And of course, depending on who is experiencing the city is going to have to feel different in the movie itself. So, for example, there's a moment where their main characters, Nora and Haesung, go take a ferry to go see the Statue of Liberty. And that moment, you know, most New Yorkers are not that interested in seeing the Statue of Liberty, but Haesung is a tourist and Nora is an immigrant. So for both of them, actually Statue of Liberty is a very powerful symbol and a kind of a romantic place for them. So it just made sense for the two of them in their character to go see Statue of Liberty, for example. So what's so funny is, like, it's kind of like, I don't know, you know, the London Bridge. I don't know if you guys really experience that. And you, I don't think you really think of that as like, wow. Or like London Eye, I don't think you're like, wow, like, you know, I think about it every day, I go there every day. I don't think that's how it is, but I think that's similarly to New Yorkers. Plenty of New Yorkers just never even been there, right? And I think that that's what's so special about these two going there. So, but of course, on the other hand, like the way that I wanted the New York apartment to feel, it was really important for me to make sure that it's an authentic representation of a New York apartment. And it was so funny, while looking for that apartment, I would just walk into a hall that's a horrible, horrible little apartment. And I would be like, this is kind of a great place for the scene. And then, of course, we will learn that we can't fit a camera, you know, like, we can't actually all be in there. Like, and then, of course, so I think some of it is about not just depicting the most beautiful things, you know, like it's not about our lives in a city is not the places that is the most beautiful. Sometimes it is just like a street corner. And I think that really was at the heart of how I wanted New York City to be seen. Like that street corner where Nora and Haesung say goodbye to each other, the street where Nora and Arthur live. I think that street, for example, is this corner that's meant to be so ordinary and so mundane, and you might just walk by without thinking twice about it. But of course, it is going to be made so special just by the fact that we experience this moment there, right? So I think that that's just true about our relationship to cities. You know, like sometimes our experience of a city is not the things that end up in the postcard. Sometimes it's just a corner that you once lived for a couple of years, right?
Do you think that, like, from your, the way you've sort of brought this story to life, and the specificities and the emotions that you kind of bring to the screen, there is a kind of dreamlike quality to everything, and that comes from the way it's shot and the way it's lit and the soundtrack, and there is this kind of like heightened, like a it's not a rose tinted memory, but like a positive memory, even if some of the interactions and feelings were quite kind of difficult to comprehend at the time.
Of course. And I think that that is our experience of it. Like that corner can be really special if that's the place that your sweetheart told you that they love you for the first time, right? And then that corner can never be the same again. And that corner can, every time you walk by that corner, you can have a special feeling about it. Mm. And that corner could be, have a garbage can on it, right? It could be a terrible corner, right? But I think that's what's amazing about places that we live. And I think that's really the at the heart of what we wanted to find when it comes to visual language. My DP, Shabe Kirchner, and I, you know, when we were talking about it, we were always looking for the thing that feels like the way we see it, right? And for example, so when we went to, when we were shooting Statue of Liberty, you know, like there are so many approaches to shooting Statue of Liberty. It's one of the most exposed statues in the world. You know, you will see Statue of Liberty all the time, right, in media. But the way I wanted to approach it is on a boat. So the Statue of Liberty is going to be a little bit crooked, right? Mm. Because you're on a, you're shooting it from a boat. And of course, you're, so there's just things like that where, and of course you're looking up at it, right? Because you're on the boat level.
Well, that's how most people see it, I imagine.
Yeah, well, that's not how people see it, because people would usually fly a drone to capture it, right? So it was this thing where it's like, so much of it is about like, well, what it is like when I'm standing here and looking at the street. And I think we're just trying to capture that feeling, because I do think that the way we see it changes the way we love it, right? Because, of course, I can love New York City that is on a drone, too. It's magnificent, right? But I think the way that I wanted New York City to be loved in the movie is as if you're just walking by it. You're just walking on the street because you live in that corner.
I guess another question I had was also was about, like, Am I understand right that the basis of the story is actually something that happened to you in real life? And I saw you've talked about the bar scene where it sort of starts and dovetails the film being an actual moment. And was that a moment that kind of triggered the idea for the film, or did that come kind of later when you were able to sort of survey the whole thing?
No, I think that really was the moment. I was sitting there with my child's sweetheart and my husband, and I was translating between these two guys, and I think I was just looking around the room and feeling like there's something really special happening between the three of us, and that there's some people in the room who are looking at us. So me and my child's sweetheart and my husband, we were being observed by some people in the bar because we were such a weird trio of people. So I remember really feeling like, first of all, I was like, you have no idea, right? You have no fucking clue who we are to each other. But also the other thing that I thought was like, I was like, hey, what if I actually told you? What if I didn't like half tell you, what if I really properly told you? What if I made you live through the things that they've lived through? And of course, we're going to be back at this scene. And then we're going to finally hear a conversation where a kind of a solution to the question, who are these three people to each other, is going to be revealed, right? And it'll be a revelatory conversation. And once I figured out that would be the structure of like introducing the three of them, introducing the audience to the mystery of who are these people to each other, and then to, you know, near the end of the film, go back to that scene after having lived through these moments in their lives, to get there and then to really talk about it, really talk about what is going on. Then I thought that's really what led me to believe that I can make this movie. And then from there, I wrote the script. Yeah, those are the first things I figured out.
I would love to know, how did the two men, were they involved in any way in terms of like, you know, discussions, or was it something you wrote and then said, and did they have access to it before it was made, or was your husband, how did he feel about you writing the story?
They didn't have access to the writing, but you know, like I feel like my husband is, you know, supportive and wonderful and excited and loves the movie.
The reason I ask that, I did, you know, there is a sense in the film where he kind of has experienced this, like, he's empathetic, but there is a sort of strangeness to the situation. And then I guess having to sort of look at it again in as a film, as something that has been captured as an experience for him, it might be, you know.
Well, I think that, but I think the part of it is that, you know, it sort of starts in that subjective experience of sitting in that bar. But of course, I think in turning it into a script, it's already been so fully objectified into an object, which is a script that like I wrote every word of, right? And then from there, there's another layer of objectification of it becoming a movie. So, which is like then now these characters are then played by actors. They're nothing, you know, in some ways, nothing like us. And I think that it really is something where it's like by the process of these two levels of objectifying, first into a script that's written and then to a movie that is made with hundreds of people, I think that in doing that, it, you know, by the end of it, you're really just making a movie and eventually you're just watching a movie. So I think that really is the relationship that it has to like the real life things, right? Because I think it's really, really more about the subjective feeling.
Yeah.
Right? More than like facts or, you know, like things like that, because that's not the thing that was the project. The project was this feeling that I had, and how does this turn into a movie? Mm-hmm. And how do I explain what this feeling is like through a movie, right? And I think that really was the process of it, you know.
Interesting. Yeah. Like, I guess it was certainly something I was thinking about, because it kind of exists on all these different planes, mm-hmm. as the film itself, because you have these real people like re-experiencing things, and I love that part of it.
I love the part where it's like this thing that was started from this subjective experience, objectified, further objectified, turned into an object, and then now that it's being received by the audience,
exactly.
They're now having a subjective experience for the object, and I think that's really what's amazing about art anyway. Right, I think all art is about turning something subjective into objective, mm-hmm. and then for the audience or the reader or the viewer to then receive it as subjective again.
Yeah,
it's so magical. You're right; it is kind of a special thing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for that. That was amazing.
Of course. That was so fun.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, Hannah, this was kind of a bit of a festival darling, and it's kind of fun. I mean, unlike El Conde, it's, you know, like it's had a very kind of slow burn and like build of buzz. Did it live up to that hype for you?
Yeah, so I was excited to see this one because it was at Sundance in January, but only in the like physical lineup. It wasn't available for international press, kind of doing the online viewing. So I'd heard about it there, and then I'd heard a lot of buzz out of the Berlin Film Festival as well. So I was quite hyped, quite excited. And then I think I saw it eventually in, I want to say, April. And I actually, I found it a very moving film, a very impressive debut, I think, from Celine Song. It's such a lovely script. I think her kind of background is in like screenwriting, like theatre.
Yeah, screenwriting and theatre.
So that kind of definitely shines through. I think like some of the kind of exchanges in the film are so beautiful. There's this whole speech, which I'm sure Hafa kind of can attest to, between Greta Lee's character and John McGarry's character, who plays her husband, and you know, they're kind of talking about their relationship and about language, and he talks about how he hears her speak in her sleep, and he can't understand her, and he says,
"You dream in a language I can't understand."
Yeah, and you can read Hafa's very beautiful review of the film on the Little White Lies website as well. It's up now. Of course, it is a very beautiful review. If you want kind of more like about that line, kind of the poignancy of that when it comes to like
a multicultural relationship.
Yeah, very impressive in my eyes. Romantic, but not kind of cloying.
Yeah.
And I'm always here for like a little cheeky John McGarry role. Like, just makes me really happy seeing him in a film. I'm like, there he is.
I mean, there's nothing more romantic to me than kind of like longing. I suppose it's why like In the Mood for Love is like such a incredibly like moving film, but it's the sort of happiness that could have been had and that you're both aware of that like breaks the heart and makes it sore at the same time. I mean, Hafa, you've written about this. It's been a while since you've seen it. Like, do you, have kind of like your feelings on it kind of evolved at all?
It's interesting because, as Hannah was saying, this was a film that came with a lot of buzz out of Sundance, and I don't always trust that, to be quite honest, especially when it's a film written by a playwright, which can be sometimes overexposed, not with any harmful intentions, of course, but it can just be an exercise in adapting a theatre play or the theatrical language to the screen, which I don't always relate to, because I think the cinema I'm most attracted to is a cinema of metaphors, mm-hmm. and it's a cinema of visual language. So I went in with a bit of caution. I saw it in Berlin during the Berlinale, because it's a film that played in competition in both festivals, which isn't that common. And I was blown away by it. As Hannah was saying, I do have a bit of a personal connection to it because I have married someone from a completely different country and culture from my own. So this idea of leaving your country and leaving the people that you love and this history that you shared with someone else and coming in and falling in love with someone who can't really relate to that really speaks to me. And I think it's done very beautifully. The sentence that Hannah just said, "You dream in a language I can't understand," I just keep repeating it in my head because it's such a simple encompassing of something that is so big, and I don't think I have ever been able to say it in that way. But it's also, I think, people keep calling it a tale of star-crossed lovers, and it is that, but I also think this is a film about lovers who have found so much joy and companionship in calmness and in being able to be with each other without that fiery passion of a relationship that is written in the stars, because it isn't. And I think relationships oftentimes are about what past lives is. It's about meeting someone unpretentiously and realizing that you share a lot of interests and you laugh about the same things and you can just have a good time. And it's done very beautifully here. And I think John Magaro is great and Greta Lee's fantastic. Mm. She's just so, so good. So it's a serendipitous work in a way that everything kind of came together to form a beautiful film. And I'm really excited that this is coming to the UK with such buzz and so many people are talking about it, because I hope it takes people to the cinema to watch a film that could have gone unnoticed without all the hubbub. So yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I love it when kind of you see someone make that leap from like character actor to kind of leading lady, mm-hmm. as like Greta Lee has done. I think she is generally one of the most kind of exciting potential kind of new leading women of her generation. Yeah. She's absolutely stunning.
I think in that fight, the final scene of the film, which I won't kind of spoil, but it's like this like one kind of long shot. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was just so kind of beautifully pitched, because her character is quite like, she's not detached, but I think she's quite like withholding in her emotions. She knows what she wants and she's not afraid to get it, but like, you know, she's quite practical, quite pragmatic, I think. And at the end, she just kind of, yeah, I think like the weight of everything and all this kind of experience she's been through, like meeting someone that she'd kind of dismissed, as you know, as part of a part of her life that doesn't exist anymore. And seeing that kind of like non-verbally materialize, I found very beautiful and kind of a real like indication of how good she is as an actress.
And it's just, I think, her understanding and the entire film's understanding that you fall in love with reminders of home, and if they come in the shape of a person, then you just confuse those feelings a little bit. This idea of familiarity and being attracted by this, and also this loving relationship with her husband, his American husband, and his understanding that her infatuation isn't physical, it is metaphorical, it is this longing for home, it is home personified. I think it's just so beautiful. This idea of possessiveness is just not here. And he understands the origins of her longing.
I actually really liked it. I think I probably were complaining that like it wasn't realistic because the husband would be more annoyed. But I'm like, well, I don't know about that. I think like I actually really liked that it didn't go like a marriage story route and you know, blazing rows. I think like actually it was a portrait of a relationship that has to be worked at, but that ultimately is like healthy and successful. Yeah. We don't get that many of those. So it was quite nice to see.
Yeah. And I mean, like, so much of a relationship is choosing to be into it.
Mm-hmm. It's compromise, yeah.
It's an active choice.
We will talk about it in another film coming up. I just think it's so lovely to see this film been embraced the way it has. And to have such kind of, as Kafa said, to have like a little buzz around it. It's really nice.
Mm-hmm. And so what would you give it in terms of scores to kind of further fuel that buzz? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Definitely a 4 in anticipation. I think I'd heard so much good stuff, but you always kind of want to temper. I mean, we're at a film festival right now, but you always want to kind of temper your expectations when people rave about stuff at a film festival, just in case it lets you down. Enjoyment, yep, 4. It made me cry. I've been saying that a lot today, I think, on this podcast. And then in retrospect, yeah, 4. I'm excited to watch it again. I think it's very beautiful. Can't wait to see what Celine does next, what Greta does next, what John McGarry does next.
Yeah, not to be a copycat, but I entirely echo those sentiments. That's exactly how I felt about it too, with the scores that I'd give. Hapa, what about you?
I think my anticipation was a 3 because, as I said, I'm like, all of these people are in the cold where Sundance happens. Everything seems to be a bit of a nuisance. I think if I watched anything that was even mildly entertaining, I would have been like, this is the best thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah. So they call it mountain fever.
Yeah, exactly.
Having been there twice, I can say that is definitely the vibe.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, this sounds okay, and I will definitely check it out, but I wasn't that excited about it. So there was a 3. And then I am a 4-4 as well. I think it's a film that not only I've been thinking about it more and more, and I will definitely revisit in the future, but it's also so fun at the time and beautiful and moving in ways that aren't too over complex when you have that first watch. You can still follow that story in a way that is greatly entertaining. So it's very good. So yeah, 3-4-4.
Well, next up, we're going to do a little kind of almost like a speed round where we're going to go through some of like the most interesting, some for different reasons, title that we've got to see on the Lido this year. It's a mini Venice special. So, Hafa, let's start off on a low note. I did not expect an 80-minute Harmony Korine film to be not only a film where so many people walked out, but it seemed like everyone but me who remained was unconscious. Mm. Could you explain why Agrodiff was so boring?
I would say, I don't want to get cancelled for saying this, but I'm going to be very upfront. The first scene in that film was so loud, I reached for my bag and I got my beautiful earplugs, and I feel like I had a much more comfortable experience than everyone who was in that room, because I could still hear it very well because it was very loud. Mm-hmm. But I have not acquired any levels of deafness, and no tinnitus for me, and it was fine. But it was so loud and bright, and for those who don't know what the film is, it is entirely shot in infrared, which means that you're seeing these bright shades of orange and yellow and blue, and at first you're just dizzy and disoriented, and then you just become increasingly more dizzy and disoriented, and then as the story keeps on going, it is a juice of misogyny and hyperbole that is like nothing else, from people's butt fat showing up on infrared to the most disgusting greasy hair I've ever seen in my life, to a lot of the B word being said in several different times. So it is an experience. I will not take it away from him, and he has gone out there, he has tried, he's shown up to Venice with his fancy little masks, bless his heart, but it is not for me, so thank you.
No. Oh my god, like, I'm just so kind of obsessed with the wife who does nothing but gently twerk throughout the entire
by
film.
By saying, I miss you, honey. Come home, daddy. Like, I love you so much. While she's sadly twerking. Yeah.
Not a film with a ton of defenders, but...
that are defending it are very, like, they want you to know that they really liked it. It didn't do anything for me either. Yeah. The only reason I'm not saying more is because my review is on the website. If anyone would care to find out just how bad it is. But I mean, my thing is, like, I do talk about this in the review, but I just, like, Harmony Korine's whole thing with this film and with his Edgelord project is that he's like, oh, I want to make movies more like video games. And I'm like, okay, how? Why? what video games specifically? I need examples. And he was asked this at the press conference and he didn't have any because he is just talking out of his ass.
He's a performative kind of director. He likes the attention.
Yeah. He likes the attention, yeah. And we're giving it him by talking about his movies.
Wow. It's okay.
He's won.
Yeah, no, it was absolutely terrible. And I say this as someone that's actually been pretty... I've defended a lot of his past work. I loved Spring Breakers.
I defended a lot of his past work.
Yeah, look at us looking like idiots now.
I was always correct. I want this podcast to note.
But from low lows to high highs, like, and I've never really seen a consensus like this in terms of everybody loves Poor Things.
Yeah, yes. I don't think I've met anyone who didn't like it. I've met people that were like, not quite as enamored as everyone else, but they still really liked it. So just really nice, isn't it, when you're excited for a film and it lives up to expectations. It doesn't happen that often, I feel like, in our line of work. This is the latest from Yorgos Lanthimos, of course. It's adapted from Alistair Gray's iconic cult novel from 1992, and it's about a kind of alternate version of Victorian England where a young lady commits suicide or dies by suicide, and her baby's brain is transplanted into her body. I've been getting this mixed up for weeks.
Well, it depends which cow you're referring to. It's
okay. Her brain is transplanted into the bin and her baby's brain is put into her body. Yeah, it sounds a bit, I mean, it sounds insane, let's be real, but it's Yorgos Lanthimos, and it's his, oh gosh, I think in order it's his second collaboration with Emma Stone, but technically now they've done so much. I think they've just revealed they've shot another film as well.
Yeah,
so
there's an anthology coming out.
Well, there's Amp, but there's also another one.
Oh, yeah, oh, think, two more in the can. That's great.
No, there's three more because they also have the short film that he only screened in Greece.
When did they have time?
I know. So our most productive actor and director combo in quite some time, I think. And I think that she's giving to him what Laura Dern gives to David Lynch in terms of like full body commitment to weird ideas. And you love to see it, you know. I she's great in the film, she's absolutely marvelous, and I think Mark Ruffalo is just as amazing as well. I'm a big fan of him anyway, but it's the first time he's had like a real balls to the wall comedy. Mm-hmm. And he's just really great in it, and I'm sure we're going to be talking so much more about it in the coming months because it's playing London Film Festival. It's going to be out in January, so there's plenty of time, but yeah, you want to get sights on this one as soon as you can. Very
100%.
Good.
I think not only the best film of the festival, but also the best Lanthimos, which I suppose actually that's probably a smaller claim, the second one, because there were more films at the festival, but never mind. Hafa, were you just as enamoured by Poor Things?
Ah, yes. I want to take a moment, all of us, including you listening, to be thankful that there are directors out there who are so out of their little houses to try something new and to play with the form of cinema in a way that is not only so well realized and so detailed and full of love and verb and exciting for the project, but also really, really great in the intertext and the metatextual and the hyperbole of the metaphors, and everything just works so well. And I feel like we've been saying that festival fever is a plague, but if you ask us a year from now, I think the excitement will still be there. Until Poor Things came along on maybe day 4 of Venice this year, maybe, correct me, but I think it was day 4, we had not seen anything that was truly exciting. I think I loved El Conde, and I've said it before, but I was very prone to loving El Conde from the beginning.
It was actually day 3 of the festival.
Ah, was it? I think we're just losing track of time.
Well, it's just like, it feels like we saw it ages ago.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was just, I remember leaving the cinema and saying, I don't think I have ever seen such consensus and excitement for a film before. I think Emma Stone is at the very best of her career. She is a force within that film of just brilliant comedic timing and just a pitch perfect dramatic command of what she's doing. And I think this is finally the film that has been the culmination of her career in terms of evolution in what she has done. And Yorgos Lanthimos is so aware of her potentials in both abilities. And Willem Dafoe is so, so, so good. People are going to be talking about Mark Ruffalo because Willem Dafoe is good in everything, I think.
Yeah.
But he is particularly delicious. There's this scene I'm not going to talk about it, obviously, but there's this dinner scene in which he gives this very brief monologue that made me laugh so much. I could feel my frontal cortex expanding as I laughed. Like, it was this new sort of, like, it was combining the humor of the dialogue and also his delivery, and it's just so good. And yeah. I think I could praise Poor Things for another 3 hours. It's great.
Well, we don't have enough time for that. And there is a small child who I think has had a disappointing gelato in the background who is like,
will not stop yelling.
This is a little tricky.
Sharing his frisbee is.
God bless him, and apologies, listener, for this. But yes, but no apologies necessary for the no David Fincher. Hafa, were you impressed by The Killer?
You know what? I am going to say this is a good movie. Mm-hmm. And saying it is a good movie, I don't think it's a bad thing. I was expecting much more from The Killer. I'm a big Fincher fan. I think he has done some canonical work. I think his cinema has revitalized the idea of the crime film in ways that I don't think have been done since the 60s and the 70s, which might be a big claim, which might be my festival brain, but I do believe it is. And I think The Killer is a movie that my dad will love on Netflix 2 years from now. It's very beautiful to look at. Michael Fassbender is great. The story is very straightforward and is done in a way that is entertaining, but I don't think this is groundbreaking in any way. The thing that I will say is that I think this film answered a question that I see doing the rounds every once in a while, which is, has technology killed the crime thriller? Mm-hmm. Has it killed the mystery thriller? And with that film, I think David Fincher is saying no, he hasn't. I think knowing how to incorporate that into your thriller and to understand the potential of technology is a very interesting thing. And you can still create suspense and mystery and tension. So I think that's my biggest kudos for this film.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that did kind of have you accidentally kind of quoting Harry Styles from last year's festival of like, it's a movie.
It is a movie. It is a movie that is a movie. And it feels like a movie.
And that, yeah, and that was no bad things. I had an absolute, like, wonderful time with this. I just had so much fun. Hannah, you're a big Fincher fan. I believe you got a Fincher tattoo to add to the ones that we all got this year. Where does this kind of rank for you in terms of, like, Finchers?
I mean, I don't think Fincher's ever made a bad film. He's definitely made films that I like less, but I don't think any of them are out, like, bad. Not even Alien 3.
The first half, at least.
I was excited for The Killer. I was hoping it would be a kind of return to the Fincher that I love best, which is the Fincher with Gone Girl and Zodiac. And I don't think it's quite on that level, but to be honest, you know, what could be really? Those films are pretty much as close to perfect as the film can be to me. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of fun with it. I really want to read the graphic novel now, because the graphic novel is much longer as well. Obviously, it's longer than a film. But I do think it's maybe a little bit bare bones, because it's just like a revenge story, really, and I think we get quite a lot of those. The plot isn't any more complex than, like, a Taken, or, you know?
Technically no more complex than Aggro Drift.
Yeah, no, not really. But obviously the execution is so much better than Aggro Drift. But, and I also will say, like, so the soundtrack, I was promised a Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score, and I got just, like, every Smith song ever.
Yeah,
like, just keep playing the Smiths in it. And, like, the first time it happened, I was like, haha, that's funny. Like, the hitman listens to the Smiths whilst he's working. And then after the 10th one, I was like, oh, my God, if I ever hear another Smith song, I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, well, I mean, that is kind of the vibe that the Smiths is trying to give you, to be fair. But, yeah, no, that was one of those things where I was just like, I loved it, and then I thought, like, this is weird, and then it just, like, circled back.
Oh, it circled back. Never circled back.
This has somehow become the funniest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, but, yeah, you know, it's Fincher at the end of the day. I will watch it again when it comes out on Netflix.
Oh, 100%.
I would love to talk to him about the genre, because it is clearly something that he has a lot of affection for. He made this lovely comment, and I think it was a Variety profile, not the comment about the strikes. We do not support his comments about the strikes.
No.
Which were basically a very nearly mild, I can see it from both sides. But he made this very funny comment about, oh, I want everyone to watch it and then be suspicious of what the person next to them at Home Depot is doing. And I was like, that is literally what Zodiac is about. You have a scene in the film where that is exactly what Jake Gyllenhaal does. I liked it with caveats, I would say. I did give it I would say my review is pretty positive. And yeah. I stand by that. But I do think if you need to kind of temper your expectations with it. If you like a thriller, if you like Fincher, you're fine.
Yeah.
If you go in expecting something on the level of girl with a dragon tattoo, or Bond girl, or Zodiac, then you're probably setting yourself up for disappointment.
I think, yeah, it's one of those ones where, I mean, I'm a big fan, but it's not necessarily that I love it, but I come to it, it's going to be very easy to recommend when people are asking me what, you know, the thing is that they should watch.
If I tell my mom to watch that, she'll love it.
Yeah.
As Hafa said, it's like, dad's in it.
Okay. Next one is one that I think will alienate most people that we recommend it to, but we all loved The Beast. Hannah, do you want to kick off what
where do we begin
and wonderful film was?
Where do we begin?
Beast.
Yeah, so this was one that we were all, I think, quite excited for. It's billed as like this kind of sci-fi film by France's Bertrand Bonello, who's a bit of a kind of maverick director, does kind of, you never really predict what he's going to do next, I think. He's quite genre hopping and he acts sometimes in things. He popped up in Titan very briefly. He just seems like a really cool guy. And this is his sort of English-language debut, but like it's mostly in French, so not really. There's only a few lines in English, but it's with Léa Seydoux, who's marvellous in everything she does, and George Mackay, who is less marvellous in everything he does, but generally quite solid as an actor. Sorry, George. And it's the story of this couple who kind of just keep finding each other across different lives. We talked about past lives earlier, now talking about a very similar thing, only more literal. And it's kind of like, yeah, they find themselves drawn to each other across three different time frames, one in the belly pot, one in 2014 and one in 2044. And it's imagining this, I believe Bonello was saying it's his kind of thing, imagining what happened, the consequences of suppressing feelings, expressing feelings. It is, yeah, it's a very kind of fantastical, highly entertaining, for the most part, take on love. I've not seen him do like a proper love story before, so that was quite novel, I thought.
Yeah, I have never felt more alienated from my wider Venice Film Festival community than during this film, because I was loving it and genuinely near the number of walkouts that Aggro Drift got. And like some of them like 15 minutes to the end at points where like I was like, I can barely breathe. This is so tense. I mean, like,
I didn't see any walkouts where I was sat.
It walked. There was a lot of walkouts. Mm. Maybe you were deeply engrossed.
I was quite near the front.
Yeah.
Everyone behind me is gone. I'm just there like, yeah. Great.
But Hafa, you were equally impressed. I think you told me this was like your number two. I mean, everyone's number one is Poor Things, but after.
Oh, yeah. So with Larraín and Bonello, those were my two most anticipated films because they are two of my favorite filmmakers that are who are currently working. I love Bonello. I have been a massive fan of Bonello for like a decade now. I think he's just a maverick of a director, as Hannah was saying. He's someone who's unafraid to try his hand at the weird and the classical and the funny and the dramatic, and he's just completely detached from the notion of creative continuity in his filmography, which I think is really exciting. The film that he released last year, Coma, which got done dirty by distributors everywhere, I just want to say, was at the Berlinale, was one of my top three favorite films of the year, and I still stand by the fact that I think it is the best pandemic movie to be made. It is a collage of anxiety and despair that is wrapped and packaged as a love letter to his daughter, to his teenage daughter, as he walks to her through a world that he finds very daunting. And I think he continues this idea with The Beast, which in my opinion is a very interesting walk through his body of work, from the belle epoque of House of Tolerance to this very to this angst and anxiety of the modern times that he comes in 2014, in the third part of this film. I was very into it. As Hannah said, I think the first hour of this film is very slow, and I have come to believe it is a way of Bonello trying to test your patience and your limits and playing with this a little bit, and I respect him for it, what can I say? But when it comes to the end, I think it is so illuminating and daring and bold, and I think there are very few filmmakers playing with this in this sense, and I would hate to think that people got bored so deeply by that first hour that they gave up on what the film then packages.
Well, that could kind of make sense to me if people like didn't have enough patience to give it space. People were leaving right up the end. I'm still furious. But as well as being furious, there was a tinge of sadness because Hafa, you love Friedkin and his kind of final film, he only died a few weeks ago, premiered here, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial.
Well, first of all, this is a tongue twister of a film. I have been calling it The Caine, Caine, Caine. Mm-hmm. But I love Friedkin. I have been quite an enthusiast of his work, and I was devastated when he died in ways that I can't quite grasp just yet. I have been emailing every single publicist who's ever lived to get near Friedkin, which proved quite a futile task in many ways. But his final film is not what I expected it to be. I felt it was slightly underwhelming. I have known people who have enjoyed it more than I did. It is basically a courtroom drama, an overextended courtroom drama of an adaptation of a classic book, and follows the trial of a man who's accused, a Navy soldier who's accused of starting a mutiny in a ship. I felt, as I said, underwhelmed by it, but towards the end, as the conclusion of this film unwraps, which I won't tell you because it is a mystery at its heart, I felt very emotional because there's such a parallel between this idea of devaluing something or someone for so long and not noticing the importance that he held until the moment that it's lost.
Yeah.
That I felt it was such a bitter and poignant parallel to the loss of a filmmaker who was revolutionary and then spent many years being undervalued by so many people and who has not had the chance to really build the crescendo of a career that I think he deserved in many ways. And I do hope that this film gets seen broadly and that his work gets discussed broadly, even though it's in the light of really sad news. But yeah, and I think Kiefer Sutherland, I just want to say, is fantastic. Jack Bauer, the one and only, that guy's funny as hell, even though his character has the funniest name ever given to a Navy general, which is Queeg. Every time this happened, every time someone says the name Queeg, I could not take this seriously, but he's great. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a strange thing coming here because there's like, it felt a little bit like maybe the Friedkin was here because it was the 50th anniversary of The Exorcist, and maybe that wasn't, its kind of inclusion wasn't necessarily a indicator of its like quality as a film. But did you kind of find merit to it beyond like that it was just a Friedkin?
It's his first film since Killer Joe, so you know, like, I was actually kind of surprised it wasn't in competition because, you know, that feels like a big deal. I did really like it, actually, as it happens. I'm a bit of a sucker for like a procedural, though. I actually saw there was an article today in Vulture saying we should bring back the procedural thriller. And I was like, freaking tried. yeah, no, I actually, despite the fact I can't spell the word Marshall to save my life, I was really taken with this. I think like it's just a very entertaining film, if you like films where men just kind of have conversations. There's a very good exchange about cheese, which involves someone saying the line, he's living the cheese business all over again, which is just so, such a funny line for anyone to say. Lance Riddick saying, I wasn't made aware of this cheese thing before time. Like, just anything Lance Riddick says in this film, and, you know, freaking absolutely seismic loss, but Lance Riddick as well, just like, it's so sad watching the film and thinking, like, he had so many great performances left in him that we'll never get to see. The film is dedicated to him as well, which is very sweet, I thought. And he's, you know, playing this, like, very, like, you know, if anyone's seen Brooklyn Nine-Nine, it's the kind of Captain Holt role. It's very, like, buttoned up, very serious, like, straight-faced. And he just does it with such kind of, you know, gusto. And there's a wonderful cut in the film to him, like a reaction shot cut, which I just found so funny. And that's the thing about the film. It's, like, it's, you know, it's kind of a serious thing they're talking about, mutiny. But there's all these, like, little comedic flourishes and William Friedkin, you know, he's associated with this kind of real darkness that's in all his films, but he was so funny as a filmmaker as well, and he wasn't afraid to kind of bring you to the edge and then pull you right back. And, yeah, it just made me kind of sad that he's gone now and we're not going to get any more from him. But I think it's a fitting way for him to go out, and Haffer had kind of beautifully summarised it. But I also think that ending is kind of like maybe him, you know, ushering in the new generation, but just kind of wanting a little bit of like respect at the same time, because when you're watching the film, you're like, I think you do kind of sit there thinking, well, I don't know whose side I'm on here. And then for Jason Clarke's character at the end, that this whole like rant about how everyone should respect their elders, you're kind of like, well, is he now the old guy shouting at the clouds? Like,
we all eventually become the old guy shouting at the clouds.
We do. And there's this lovely bit, the lovely quote that was at the beginning of the film, which the festival kind of put on as a tribute to him, something Friedkin said about his own work. I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, all of the stories I have chosen to tell during my career were about the thin line between good and evil, the thin line that exists in all of us. And this is, this is what that film is about. It's about, you know, kind of right and wrong, and arguing right and wrong in a court of law. And I just, I think it's a really interesting addition to his filmography, and I'm very glad I got to see it in a room full of people that I think generally appreciated it.
Yes, a far better selection than perhaps either stayed for Agrodrift or left for The Beast. Well, I mean, from someone who's coming into a filmmaker that they absolutely love to someone who's coming into a filmmaker that they are a famed hater for. Hannah, what did you think of Hitman?
Yeah, so everyone, I mean, we may have even mentioned it on this podcast before. I'm not really a big fan of Richard Linklater. I think I'm correct in such an opinion. I like his comedies, and everyone's been like, Well, Hannah likes a Linklater. And I'm like, I like School of Rock. I like Everybody Wants Some. I like Days of Confusion.
You like Everybody Wants Some?
Yes.
Oh, that didn't. Okay. Fair enough. Sanity prevailed.
So I was kind of, tempered expectations going into this one. But I'm a big fan of Glenn Powell, who is the co-writer and the star of this film and a very good friend of Richard Linklater's. So, yeah, I was, kind of not sure what to think. Not sure if it's going to be any good. It's out of comp as well. That can kind of go either way at a film festival. It's either the best thing you're going to see on festival or the worst thing you're going to see on festival. But I was so, so pleasantly surprised with this film. I think it's just a delight. The laughter in that screening. I think it probably got the biggest round of applause in a film I saw here, but then I didn't watch Poor Things, so I can't quite compare. But
it did.
I did watch it, just not here. I didn't watch it at the festival, sorry. I didn't just talk at length about the film and go, no, I've not actually seen it. I have seen Poor Things, just didn't see it in Venice. But unendingly delightful film. Just so sharp and funny and well observed. And for the listeners who may not have heard about what this is about, it's about a man called Gary Marshall, who was a real man, and he is this mild-mannered, awkward college psychology professor at the University of New Orleans. And he, as academia doesn't pay like it used to, he has a side gig working on wiretapping and entrapment for the police department. So he's the guy in the van, the pizza van around the corner, making sure that they get the intel. And he just happens to work on contract killings, so it's people that are trying to kill their spouse or their enemy, whatever. So one day he goes into work and he's asked to kind of fill in and be the undercover officer posing as a hitman, and he discovers he's got a real knack for it, and then things kind of escalate from there, shall we say. It's just like, it feels so rare we get a comedy that is like original and well constructed and has actual jokes and has charisma, and that this just had it in spades for me. I was so thrilled to be pleasantly surprised, and I think Glenn Powell is just absolutely magnificent. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's playing the London Film Festival as well, so definitely get a ticket. It's really, really good.
You heard it here, folks. Another great film from Richard Linklater and his incredible filmography.
David Jenkins will be very happy.
Hafa, what about you? Any thoughts on The Hitman aside from it was really funny and charming?
I mean, I'm on the other spectrum of the Richard Linklaterness of it all.
You like his like emotional films.
I love his emotional films. I love the Before trilogy. Boyhood's one of my favorite films of all time.
Yeah.
Sorry to be that Tumblr person, but I love that film with all of my heart. I think he is one of the great contemporary American filmmakers to understand emotion and teenagehood in ways that I think it's sometimes underappreciated, but I respect it. So when I see that he's doing a comedy, I love School of Rock, but I'm like, can you please get back to the films that I love in a way? And I feel kind of like, oh, fine, I'll go in. And I bit my tongue. I loved it. I like Glenn Powell, and now I love Glenn Powell. I think he is truly the messiah of American rom-coms. He has saved it. He has risen. He's sexy as hell. That man is a snack. And the delivery of his lines and his whole physicality, and he gets to wear different costumes in this film, which means that he gets to play different characters with snippets of these personalities that he has created. And I think for an actor to prove themselves to be a comedic actor is a big one, but to do it in such a stylistic and plural kind of way is another one. It's just so be sexy and
be sexy, charismatic, and funny, and a little bit dorky.
1,000%. I think it's very hard to do.
Yeah, and what an inspiring message for us all, that if you're not sexy, maybe you can just choose to be.
Yeah, not being sexy is a skill problem. It is a skill issue that you can definitely improve. So I was so heartwarming to see such a thunderous reaction to the film in Venice. I think Richard Linklater is often underappreciated. Yeah, but he can be underappreciated. He can be the guy who is, everyone's like, oh, great, but no one's, oh, great, for quite some time.
Not since Boyhood, I think.
Yeah.
But I know that film means a lot to a lot.
For the past few years, it just, even Apollo
10 and a half,
again, I liked it. Movie. I liked it, but I didn't love it. But I love Hitman. I think everyone who can watch in some way, I don't know what distribution looks like for this film yet, but I hope you get to watch it in a cinema with other people who are going to be going down this roller coaster with you, because it is a hoot.
It is indeed. But yeah, I mean, there were so many other exciting films, and I think a lot of them are going to be coming up on future episodes. We just kind of didn't have enough time to pack every single thing in, but like lots of other
just, like,
really
hot
cool
shots of like quick wrecks, things that we think people should check out when they arrive.
Honestly, I can't remember anything's name.
I've now forgot every single film I've ever seen. Sky Peels.
Sky Peel's wonderful. I saw a film today called Io Capitano, which I think it was like a full 5-star, absolutely beautifully brilliant film. I cannot recommend that one enough. But yeah, plenty of others. What about you?
Sky Peel's would be my kind of smaller recommendation. There's this film called Housekeeping for Beginners, which I didn't love, but I think is interesting enough to warrant a watch. Mm. It's by this Macedonian filmmaker called Goran Stovleski, who directed this film You Won't Be Alone last year with Noumi Rapace, which I think a lot of people liked. And this one's about this sort of this queer man and woman in Macedonia who kind of have this safe house for this group of motley crew of kind of queer people that live with them, and it's very sweet, and it doesn't totally work, but I think when it does work, it's really delightful. So that would be a kind of small recommendation. I've heard like a lot of good things about other kind of titles I'm kind of keen to check out if they do the festival circuit, but I mean, the problem is a festival like Venice, things only tend to screen in kind of rigid set times. It's quite hard to like put in more than 3 films a day because the way the schedule works, but I was mainly on the comp beat this year. And I do think, like, I've not seen anything I viscerally hated apart from Aggro Drift.
Yeah.
So that's, like, quite a good...
And that's good that happened to us early on. So then it was, like, an upward trajectory.
Yeah. We got that one out of the way quite early.
So, thank you very much for listening and being patient for the fact that we are live on the ground and all of the kind of interesting audio stuff happening in the background. Because of it, but you know, we wanted to kind of bring you with us to like this wonderful experience of being at a festival. Next week we'll be having a look at Fromont, Rotting in the Sun, and for Film Club it'll be Jim Jarmusch's Stranger Than Paradise. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth the Movie is hosted by me, Leila Latif. My guests this week were Hannah Strong and Hafiz Alice Ross. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.